Hello. Before you dive into this lovely episode with Marin Lewis on Aileen Shona, I just wanted to tell you about our gorgeous new merch, which is on sale now. It's been designed by the brilliant artist and Boss Morris dancer, Alex Merry, and features a paper-cut image blending our folk-on-foot passions of nature, music and walking. There are T-shirts, sweatshirts and hoodies in a variety of sizes and colours, plus tote bags, mugs and art prints to brighten up your walls. Just go to folkonfoot.com/shop to browse the collection. And when you're buying, you'll have the added satisfaction of knowing that all profits go back into making more episodes of Folk on Foot. That's folkonfoot.com/shop. Happy shopping! It's about 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning in October, and I am looking at the most spectacular view. We're on the Ardnamurchan Peninsula on the west coast of Scotland, and the waves are lapping up against the shore here, and we're about to get on a boat with Marin Lewis, the piper and fiddle player, who's here with us. And this is a very personal place for you, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the island that I grew up on.
Aileen Shona, we're looking at it now, just across the water. It's about a 10-minute boat ride, isn't it?
Yeah, well excited.
And I spent many a holiday here, and we're going to explore a kind of nostalgic homeward journey on the other side of the water. And I have to say, the view is wonderful, because in the foreground, there's a ruined castle, as if it had been placed there by a postcard salesman. It's just exactly what you expect to see here in the Highlands. So let's get on the boat and get
Amazing.
Over there.
Yeah.
So we just walk up a pontoon floating on the water up onto the island. How does it feel to be coming back here, Marin?
It's amazing. It's my favourite place in the world, and it always just feels really special to be home.
We should just say a few words about the island, because it's a place where I first started coming on holiday nearly 30 years ago, thanks to the generosity of the owner, Vanessa Branson, and her family. Had some idyllic times here, a bit like swallows and Amazons, where my young children would come and we'd play and mess about on boats and eat langoustines and oysters on the beach and have bonfires, and just an amazing place. But tell us a bit about the size and shape of the island.
Yeah, it's about 2.5 kilometres long. There's a nice big hill on it that's about 265 metres high. One side of it's covered in trees, and the other side's kind of quite barren and deer land, I guess.
And there are no cars on the island, are there?
No cars, just quad bikes.
Right. And there's some holiday cottages here and a big house.
Yeah.
So the big house, and I think they're rented out. So there are very few permanent residents.
Yeah. When I lived here, my family and me were just the only residents on the island, and we had one of the wee cottages on the water.
Oh, my goodness. Can we go and have a look at the cottage?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, let's walk along. So, as I remember it, your mum and dad were working here, effectively, running the island.
Yeah, they were the caretakers, essentially. My mum did a lot of cooking and a lot of the kind of hosting, and my dad was kind of doing maintenance stuff and did the boats back and forward.
And that's the only way to get here. You come by the island's own boat, little boat, 10 minutes across the water.
Yeah, you can get by boat. There's also, on a very low tide, you can get across on a wee causeway, but it's a bit of a trek.
Right. So it's not that far from the mainland, but there is something special and different about it. There's a sense of peace here, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly quiet when you stop talking. You can just hear birds and the wind and the sound of the water, and it's really special, and you don't realise, I think, until you don't hear cars and, you know, electrics and planes and things like this, how much noise they actually make in our everyday life.
So it's a peaceful place away from everything. I wonder about the circumstances of your birth, because were you born here?
I was nearly born on the island. My mum went into labour on the island, and we had to get a little boat across on a very low tide, so it means navigating a sandbank, and nearly was born on that sandbank.
Oh, really? So your dad was piloting the boat.
My dad was piloting the boat.
Mum was in labour on the boat, And did it go aground?
For the first time ever, I have my parents living there. My dad managed to ground the boat.
Oh, my goodness.
This was at air about 3 a.m. in the morning, to be fair.
3 a.m., my goodness. And then an ambulance came.
An ambulance met us on the mainland and took us to Fort William.
Right. So you weren't quite born here, but your very earliest memories must be here.
Yeah, all of my earliest memories are here, playing on the beach or swimming or something like that.
So just walking up from the jetty, you can see a boathouse on the right here with a red roof, which I think has been converted into accommodation now, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah. It used to be the old sail loft, and it was a bit of a rundown building, so it's nice to see it be made into something fresh.
And then just through the trees, you can begin to see the outline of the main house. And people have house parties here, do they?
So I'm told.
They must have been doing that when you were here, though, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there was all kinds of big parties happening. I think when my parents first moved here, I wasn't born at this point, but the owner had their 40th party for 200 people, and my parents were thrown in at the deep end there.
So they had to cater for that, yeah. I mean, yeah. Getting stuff here must be quite a challenge, I would imagine, because we're in quite a remote spot.
Yeah, I mean, everything has to come from Fort William, or it gets delivered, if it's local stuff, to the mainland, and then gets picked up by boat.
So did you have to go to school by boat when you were growing up?
I went to school for a very short period of time, about 3 weeks.
Right. Which involved a daily boat trip, presumably.
Two daily boat trips, yeah. It took us about an hour to get to school, all in all.
And then what happened after 3 weeks?
After 3 weeks, I said I didn't want to go to school anymore.
Right.
To which I think my parents were delighted, not having to do the journey. So, yeah, I was homeschooled then for the rest of the time that we were on the island.
Right, and I think you have a brother.
I have an older brother, yes.
Yeah, so was he homeschooled as well?
Yes, on the island, yeah.
Right, so what was school like on the island?
School on the island was mostly woodworking, fishing, cooking, these kind of things. I don't think I realised how much I was learning until I actually went to school. And obviously we'd not done so much of the kind of reading and writing, but actually I had a really big fascination with maths when I was little, and I used to kind of be obsessed with numbers and shapes and things like that. I don't know, I think that played into music a little bit. They definitely say that, like, maths and music are deeply connected, and I think that was maybe the start of something. But it was a very kind of free space to learn, and yeah, very child-led.
And being outside in this landscape must have been amazing. What sort of games did you get up to?
Mostly building dens, I think. Cutting wood. There used to be a load of rhododendron on the island before it was all cut down, and it was the best thing in the world as a small child to just hide in.
And we're walking through some mighty trees here, aren't we? I mean, gargantuan trunks and branches reaching up into the air. I think the island's quite famous for its arboretum, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got a load of incredible trees and quite rare species that were planted back in the 1800s, I think. And it's absolutely beautiful now. And it's amazing, I guess, that somebody had the hindsight to do that. And, you know, they were creating it for many generations later.
It has an interesting history, this island, though, doesn't it? Because I think the writer J.M. Barrie came here, so the story has it, and was inspired to create Neverland for Peter Pan by the beauty of the island. Have you heard that story?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's amazing to think that he came here and came up with that after it, but I can definitely relate to that sense of kind of childhood wonder and freedom here.
And we're just coming now to the village hall, as they call it. I suppose there must have been a village here, and there must have been a community at one time, even though there isn't any more.
Yeah, I think about 100 years ago, maybe a little bit more, there was up to about 100 people living on the island. And there was an old schoolhouse. There still is an old schoolhouse, I guess, but it's not used as a school.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there was a whole community that was thriving here.
And the wood-clad village hall has a boat outside it, up on bricks here. Do you recognise the boat?
Yeah, it's an old wooden boat. Spent many a day playing in that when I was a child.
Did it sail before? Was it in the water, or has it always been up here on bricks?
I think we had it in the water for a couple of hours at a time, but most of that was bailing.
It's definitely got a few holes in it now.
Yeah.
Let's just pop our stuff in here, because this hall is where you're going to play a gig later on. A couple of other musicians are coming to join you, I think, Mally, aren't they?
Yeah, the rest of my band is coming over on a wee boat later on, and we're going to do a wee performance in the village hall, which is quite special, really. I have played here a couple of times, but it's a space that I used to play growing up, and we would sometimes do some of the schooling stuff here, like just art and things. And yeah, it's amazing to kind of be able to share that music with some of the people here now.
And it's got a wonderful atmosphere in here. They've put out some rows of chairs, but there are some benches with beautiful dark purple cushions on them, and then lights hanging from the ceiling. But it's very much a old wooden shed, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful little space. I reckon you could probably fit like 60 people in here maybe at a push, so hopefully we get that today.
So just coming out of the village hall and down the track ahead of us is where I think your parents and you used to live.
Yeah, this is... I still think of it as my home, to be honest. It's a beautiful wee cottage that just... It looks out across the loch here.
To the castle.
To the castle, yeah. There's this ruined castle that we passed on the way here, and it's honestly one of the most, if not the most beautiful view in the world, I think. And I was so lucky as a child to experience that.
Did you take it for granted when you were younger?
I think I didn't know any better. So yeah, I just, this was my world. This whole island was my world, and Fort William was the bright lights. yeah, I'm not sure I knew much else beyond that.
And did you see any other children, or were you often just you and your brother alone here playing?
There was always a lot of children coming back and forth, and there was people that would come and stay in the cottages that would be here every year. So there was people that would kind of build up friendships with. There was also a few kids on the island and some people that went to school with and things. So there was definitely a community. Like, it's not quite as isolated as some people think, but yeah.
And look at this cottage now. It's a stone-built cottage with white-framed windows, just nestling on a slight hill above the water, and there's a very convenient looking table out the front of it there. Can you get down to the sea here?
Yeah, there's a beautiful little beach just below the cottage, a little pebbly shore. It's a lovely wee spot.
Would it be a good place to play, do you think?
I had exactly that spot in mind.
Great minds think alike. Let's walk down there. Was there any problems with water supply and electricity and that kind of thing?
There's a wee reservoir that's the water supply for the island, and it was always pretty good. Occasionally my dad would have to go and fish an eel out or a toad that had got pressed up against the filter. When the water pressure went low, you knew that was what you had to go and do.
I remember being here one very, very cold winter when the pipes froze coming into the house, and we had to go out and try and trace the place where they'd frozen because all the water supply stopped. And look, there's a little camping ground here where people have had a bonfire.
Yeah.
Very nice. And there's a carpet of moss, which makes everything look rather magical around the trees. And there's a swing.
There's a swing.
Did you used to swing on that?
I don't think it's that exact one. I think the one I had rotted away. But yeah, there's a little rope swing.
The rope swing hanging from a tree.
Half a fence post cut in half.
So we're just coming down a little set of moss-covered stone steps. And now the moss has given way to seaweed underfoot. And when we first got here, it was raining. But now the sun's come out, and we can see the hills of the mainland spread out in front of us across the water. And there's a great rock here that would be a good place for you to sit and play. Why don't you sit there and look picturesque?
Okay.
In the middle of the landscape. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play you a wee tune that I wrote when I was maybe 18 years old, and it's called Hyraeth. It's a Welsh word that means longing for a time or a place that you cannot return to, or that never quite existed. And I think it's a word that kind of sums up the human condition and trying to put something into words that you can't quite grasp. For me, the tune means kind of two things. The first is this nostalgia of my childhood and living in this magical place and longing to return here, but almost never being able to quite grasp that again. And the second is a political world in which everyone can feel safe and welcome in. And I don't know if that part of the world ever existed at any time in history, and I don't know if it ever will exist in the future, but I really hope one day the world can get to a place where everyone can feel safe and welcome.
I'd love to hear it. Well, we've had some spine-tingling moments on this podcast, but that was up there with the best of them. Just to hear you playing that beautiful music, sitting on the rock as the waves lapped on the shore, the birds started singing, and then the sun broke through the clouds, and just looking across the water sort of illuminated the whole of this area. How did it feel to play it here?
It's really special. I mean, yeah, I've played that a lot at gigs and things, but I don't know, just feel like I could savour every note here and enjoy it, and it felt really in the moment. That's nice.
And the pipes somehow are perfect here, aren't they? I mean, you can see they're coming to their own in this landscape.
It's their natural habitat, yeah.
Yeah. Where are we going to go now?
I think we'll go to the lily pond. I think it was the old reservoir at some point. And it's just covered in lilies.
That sounds beautiful. Let's go. So, Madeline, what age were you when you left the island?
So I was 7 years old when I left, and we moved to Skye after that.
So just for a bigger island?
For a bigger island, but it felt like, you know, the bright lights of Portree at this point.
Well, because it's a very much bigger island, isn't it? Was it a bit of a shock to your system when you moved to an island where there was hustle and bustle and lots of people about?
Yeah, it was a big change. I mean, the island at the point, Skye, had about 10,000 people on it, and yeah, it was a big change for us, and we got a little croft, and my dad almost single-handedly built our house. And
he's handy like that, isn't he?
He's very handy. And yeah, we had the little caravan that we stayed in.
While he was building it?
While he was building it, yeah. And he made this amazing house that was a B&B.
And did you go to school there?
Yeah, I started school pretty soon once I arrived. My parents asked if I wanted to go to school, and I said yes, and went to a wee primary school nearby.
And how was that? Because obviously having been homeschooled for a time, that must have been a big change for you.
Yeah. So I went into school, I think primary two. Yeah, it was a big change. I think there was bits of it I enjoyed, and it was nice kind of having that routine, I guess. But I never loved school. It was always quite a difficult thing for me. And not necessarily the actual work itself, but just, I think I got bullied quite a lot in school, and it was quite a difficult time for me until I'd got quite a lot older, I think.
And how did you cope with that?
So, yeah, I was having quite a rough time in school, and I was quite bored overall. And my mum suggested that I take up an instrument, and the options in the school were clarsach or bagpipes.
And a clarsach is the harp, isn't it?
The harp, yes. Yeah. And, yeah, I'd heard bagpipes when I was wee. People like Ian McFarlane live nearby, and so I'd heard it at kind of New Year's and things and Kayleigh's. So I said, yeah, I'll take the bagpipes. I threw myself into it from the beginning. I don't think I ever had to be asked to practice. And
what do you think it was about them that struck such an amazing chord with you, if you'll excuse the expression?
I think it's the raw timbre of them. It's the immersive sound that is almost overwhelming at times. It's the three drones going with the chanter, and they're massively loud. And yeah, just the actual sound of them is so rich and so pure, and you've got the bass drone, and the way all the drones interplay with each other, you get these amazing harmonics and these amazing kind of overtones and things that just honestly just fascinated me. And I'm not sure, I didn't have the words for it when I was a small child, but that's what I understand it as now. It's this thing of just being, just listening, deep listening kind of thing to the sound. And the melodies were a separate thing almost to just the raw noise of them.
And was it quite a common thing for young people at your school to learn the pipes?
There was always a few people who would learn the bagpipes kind of in each year, so it was a fairly normal thing, but there was not loads of people that kind of kept it going for more than a couple of years, I think. Definitely on the West Coast, it's a more normal thing to learn. It's kind of like people are always surprised when I tell them that there wasn't piano lessons, there was bagpipe lessons.
And the image I have of the bagpipes is of a Scottish soldier, maybe, with the great big bag and the massive instrument. But did you start on a much smaller instrument?
So, yeah, when you start learning the pipes, you learn on a practice chanter. And the practice chanter is like a little, it's just the melody, but it's quite a buzzy sound. not the most amazing sound in itself as an instrument. And you sort of build it up one at a time. So you learn the chanter, then you get a goose pipe, it's called, where it's just the bag with the chanter. So you learn how to use the bag and blow into that. And then you add one drone on at a time.
And then you make a fearsome noise. And how did your parents cope with you practicing all the time?
I think they were okay. Sometimes they had to ask me to stop when we had the bed and breakfast.
When you had guests?
Yeah, when there was guests staying, it was a bit noisy, and I admit there was times it probably didn't sound as good as it maybe does now. But I think definitely when I was learning in the caravan, that was the hard bit when we were in a tight space.
So they were locked in a caravan with somebody learning the bagpipes.
And the fiddle at this point.
I can see how that might be a bit tough. But obviously you persevered with it. Was it something that your teachers encouraged?
Yeah, I had an amazing teacher in the school called Ian Rury Finlayson. And he really looked after the kids that put in the work, I think. I mean, I always loved practicing and saw it as this thing of enjoyment and escapism, I think, as well, from school and things. And
did your other studies suffer as a result of your obsession with the pipes?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like I said, I always enjoyed maths and things, and I always got on with school, but it was never my passion. I never loved it. I did it because I was quite a competitive child, and so would try in that sense, but it wasn't my love, and I didn't feel like I was expressing myself with it in any way.
Well, now we're just walking alongside an area of water on our left. Is this the reservoir that you were talking about? And this is the lily pond, right, okay.
Fewer lilies than there once was.
Yeah, because I can remember this being covered with lilies, and there are far fewer, aren't there?
Yeah.
But it's a lovely spot. Perhaps for some more music?
Yeah, definitely. There's a wee tree over here that we used to play under. It's got conkers. We used to collect lots of conkers. So,
did you actually start to make your own instruments?
So ever since I started learning the chanter, I started trying to make chanters as well. And like I say, I was fascinated with the sound. And I used to get little sticks made of willow or things. And I'd get a drill, and I would drill two holes from either end and try and meet this drill in the middle.
Were there a lot of disasters?
There was a lot of disasters, but it was there was a lot of wood, so it was fine. And so I'd get a chanter, drill a hole in it, and then I'd drill holes.
For the fingers?
For the finger holes, yeah. And I would take the chanter reed and I'd put it in that and try and get a tune out of these things. And at very best, they made different notes. Not in tune. But yeah, ever since I started playing, I had this fascination with the sound, and I wanted to understand it and recreate it and adapt it. So when I was about 14 years old, I managed to get in touch with this woodturner who lived on Skye called Alan Soulsby, and he very generously with his time taught me how to woodturn, and together we kind of made this set of bagpipes. And it happened over many, many months, but I made this first set of small pipes at this time. And I remember the first big challenge that I had was trying to get this hole down the middle that was dead straight and dead long, 5mm hole. And I got some advice from another pipe maker who told me to get gun drills. So they're the same drills that you would make a gun barrel with. And they're super sharp, super hardened steel. And it's got a compressed air hole going through the middle. So you could make these amazing long tubes of ebony I made the pipes out of. And so when I was 14 years old, I finished making my first set of pipes and kind of ran with that. And over this time, I'd started playing in sessions and started learning small pipes and border pipes and fiddle and different instruments. And yeah, the small pipes just became my babies at this point, and I kept making them.
Trying each time to get better and better at doing it?
Yeah. I mean, the first set I was totally happy with. I didn't think they would come out this well, basically.
Must have been great when you first sat down and played them.
It was amazing. It was totally, a life-changing experience kind of thing.
But what about making the bag? Because I understand it must be so difficult to drill through the wood, but also making the fabric and the bag must be difficult too, isn't it?
Yeah. So the first bag I made out of leather, and I spent ages researching what leather to get, and I ended up buying some car seat leather because it's chrome tanned, and so it's got kind of airtight seal on it, essentially. And so I bought some leather for, I think, BMWs or Mercedes. They were very nice. And hand-stitched this bag for the pipes. And to my amazement, it was almost completely airtight at this point. And I was super happy with it. So it worked for the first time. After that, I tried different things by lining the bag with neoprene-type stuff. And in the end, I made a bag that I was really happy with. but with calluses on my hands, I decided to start buying them from someone else.
Because it's just too much hard work.
When you're not set up to make things, I was doing all of this in a tiny little shed. And so when you're not set up to do each specific job in a different area, it's very time consuming. So when somebody else has a whole setup for it and can make it in a day, then it's much better to just buy these things.
But did you try to modify the pipes as you carried on making them? Did you try to make them make different noises than the conventional ones?
Yeah, I was always fascinated by how you could make something, you know, how you can develop an instrument. And it started off by trying to make these chanters and drones with perfectly smooth bores that had no edges on them, essentially, inside. So this was building reamers at this point to carve out the inside. And then I distinctly remember when I was maybe 16, 17 years old, I was with a friend in a cafe and we're chatting about just music in general and pipe making. And there was this guy that he told me about called Donald Lindsay, who was 3D printing bagpipes. And my friend told me that he'd made this pipe that was 2 octaves and chromatic. And I couldn't understand how this was possible, and they were explaining that it's a straight bore instrument, it's a small pipe essentially. And at the time I couldn't understand how that was possible. It sat in the back of my mind, and anyway, a year later I saw Donald Lindsay's work online, and I contacted him and said, hey, can I try this instrument out? Because it seemed too good to be true almost. And so we met in the bottom of the piping centre in Glasgow, and he sat down in one of the little practice rooms with me there, and I just tried this instrument of his that's all different colours, blue, yellow, orange, 3D printed bagpipes. And it just blew my mind. It was this incredible thing that was like the instrument I play, but it had twice as many notes, and it could play all the chromatic notes in between. And it had such a rich, low sound, but also such this beautiful kind of high pitch wailing sound. And I said to him there and then, I was like, do you mind if I could try and make this out of wood and out of natural materials? And he was totally excited about it and was really lovely and said, absolutely, of course. And he's just interested in, you know, developing this instrument. And so I went home that summer, just spent the whole summer basically trying to make this instrument. And it took me about a month the first time to make one chanter, doing every little detail on it. And again, to my surprise, it was really in tune. It worked, it could play all the notes and things. And so I had now the first ever wooden Lindsay system chanter, and it changed the way I saw music. And all of a sudden I had this instrument that was so unique, and there wasn't a repertoire for it. There was no music as such written, just the odd tune that Donald had already composed for it. And so I spent this summer kind of between high school and university learning how to play this instrument at the same time, learning how to make it, learning how to play it, and also began composing music for it so that there was a repertoire. And one of the tunes that came out of this I named Trans, and it utilizes all the different notes on this small pipe, but moreover it was a kind of time in my life when I was changing and really coming to terms with my trans identity and being genderqueer. And it was a moment where I felt joy in that, and I changed from being anxious and it was a difficult thing in my life to being this thing of joy and this thing that I could be proud of. And so I wrote this tune called Trans that is just a tune of joy and trans euphoria. And yeah, it's still one of my favourite tunes to this day.
I'd like to talk more about that in a minute, but would you play the tune for us here by the Lily Pond?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. wonderful. Can I just ask, is this a set of pipes that you made yourself?
Yeah, these are my babies.
So how long have you had these ones?
I think I made these when I was maybe 19, and the drones and the bag are all kind of the original bits, and the chanter is the second iteration of the chanter, so it was a bit more refined and a bit more honed.
And I'm beginning to hear your personal stamp on the music. I'm beginning to hear you moving away from perhaps some of the traditional sounds and creating a specific Malin sound.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up playing West Coast bagpipe music on the Highland Pipes, and I'd always had a fascination with things that I don't understand. So I remember when I was learning the chanter, there was this tune called the Glasgow City Police Pipers. It's a really common pipe tune that most pipers will know. And I listened to it and I couldn't understand how the sounds were being made and how the pattern of notes created this kind of syncopated feeling. And once I'd learnt the tune, that magic was kind of lost almost, because I couldn't not know it anymore. I couldn't unsee it. And so this idea of searching for things that I don't understand, I started to find the joy in that and the love of it. And I began getting really into kind of Eastern European bagpiping. All these incredible rhythms that at this point I didn't understand. And yeah, kind of threw myself into learning different styles of bagpipe music. And I feel that these have really influenced the music that I write now and the music that I enjoy.
So where should we go from here?
I think from here, if we go back to the South Channel, there's a really beautiful little bothy sort of this old house that's we could go and have a tune in. And on the way, I think there's some really beautiful woods and there's this little stream running down the hill.
Oh, let's go and do that. That sounds fantastic. And I wanted to ask you more about your trans identity. And you talked about how when you wrote that tune, you were full of joy about it. But was it something that you struggled with earlier in your teenage years?
I think it was something that I didn't understand. And growing up on the West Coast, on the Isle of Skye, I didn't have the words for it. So I didn't have the language. And I think language is such a powerful thing. And the words that we know and the words that we use, and even more so the people around you, the words that they use and that they have. Until I was about 14 years old, I think, maybe 15, I didn't have the actual language to express myself and to understand who I was. And then it comes back to this thing of being drawn to the unknown almost, I think. I had a few years where it was a confusing time and a time of learning, but through that I came to enjoy it and feel proud of my identity and to be who I am.
Did you have help? Were there people you could talk to about what you were going through?
Yeah, I had a really amazing supportive family and a pretty good network of friends that I could rely on. I had some help through the Sandyford Counselling Service, and they were amazing, but the system is really overrun and there just isn't the provisions just now in a lot of places. So yeah, the help was invaluable, but I really hope that the help can be available now for more people soon.
And was there a kind of coming out process? Did you gradually tell people about your identity?
Yeah, there was never one moment when I came out. I was just telling friends and family individually at times. And I do think that that tune, Trans, for me was, it's my coming out tune almost.
Yeah.
I found it a way of talking about that stuff and expressing that on stage. And that's an incredibly amazing and powerful thing to be able to share with audience members, who many of which will come and tell you afterwards that they've never come into actual contact with someone. And so, you know, just
someone
now
who's trans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the media just now is demonizing trans people a lot. And so I have some really amazing conversations with people after concerts when they come and talk to me and we get to actually have a real conversation about it. And yeah, I feel incredibly lucky to have that platform to be able to share those things on stage and talk about it. And also talk about it in a way that is joyous and a celebration, because it's not always portrayed in that way.
And did you worry about or agonize about being so public about it, you know, raising your head above the parapet in the sense that some people might be cruel to you or you might find difficulties?
Yeah, there's always the fear of that, and fear is what is being thrown around a lot just now. I had to come to terms with that, but at the end of the day, it's who I am, and so it's me living my reality and living as myself. And therefore, whilst you do get abuse sometimes and you get rubbish things happening, the overall experience is one of celebration and feeling content and free to be who I am.
And did you come into contact with other LGBT people in the folk scene?
Yeah, there was a really big turning point for me in that. Growing up, I'd never had that community around me, bar the odd person. But when I moved to Glasgow, there was this call out for LGBTQ plus musicians to join a kind of, it was a workshop weekend, I guess. And Pedro Cameron hosted these workshops in Edinburgh at the Scottish Storytelling Centre, along with Laura Wilkie and Mallet Felt. And we had this incredible weekend of sharing music and stories and just some really special, beautiful people there.
Must have felt wonderful to be in the embrace of that community.
It was, and it was so good to share similar experience with different people. You know, we came together through these two things that we loved, folk music and our queer identity. And it was a real time of celebration and sharing and solidarity where we could discuss both these things in a kind of intersectional way. And through that, we ended up doing a performance at Celtic Connections. And we did that for a couple of years after that, where, yeah, all these performers just got up on stage and not all the music was about queer identity. And that was kind of what I loved. It was, some of it was just, these are some really great musicians who are part of this community, but this is them doing their thing. And seeing that celebrated on such a big stage was a real joy.
And you mentioned language. Can you help us with the language and tell us how you describe your own identity now?
Yeah, so I use they, them pronouns, and I identify as trans non-binary.
The non-binary idea, which I think I've heard you talk about before, about not wishing to be somebody who is either one or the other, I think is a really interesting concept.
Yeah, these words and identities are really powerful for me, and through language, the language gives us power, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's a real way to occupy the spaces in between and not be pigeonholed into things. And I often find that with pronouns of she and he, people make assumptions and they put you into boxes, whilst they, for me, feels like a space where I can be myself and create my own identity within that.
So we're climbing up a hill through the woods now, and there's a stream to our left, and I do believe that just under my feet here is the water pipe. We had to unfreeze one winter. It's blue, and just coming up through the path, this is like into the interior of the island, and again, astonishing trees, one just towering up above us with no foliage for meter after meter after meter, until you get to the top and it suddenly bursts out, and then some stumps of trees that have fallen on either side, and we're climbing up. Feels like you might meet the Ents here.
Yeah.
And then crossing a wooden bridge over the stream, which is just cascading down the hill. So beautiful here, isn't it? And I think we can see the remains of the rhododendrons that used to cover this area.
Yeah, they're starting to fight back.
Yeah, they're coming back.
And just up here is the reservoir that we have to unstick the toads from.
And where are we heading now, Malin?
We're just heading over the hill to the wee bothy of Ariane. Hopefully I can remember my way there from a small child.
I don't think I'd mind being lost here, actually. So all the time, I'm guessing you're sort of honing your own practice. And then I think you went to Finland. How did that come about?
So halfway through RCS, I got the opportunity to study at the Sibelius Academy in Helsinki. And it's an incredible school. It breaks down the barriers between different genres. And whilst they have an incredible tradition of their own, musicians take more inspiration from jazz and classical and things there. And I got the chance to learn from some incredible musicians, from the band Frigg and individuals like Timo Alakotila. One of the main things that came out of that experience was a love for improvisation. I had this amazing folk improvisation teacher called Joko Kuhala, and he was teaching how to improvise around folk melodies and folk structures. And we were a group of about five or six, and we would learn these little ancient melodies that are about 2 bars long, and we would just play them again and again, round and round. And what happened was we spoke deeply about the experiences we had when we were playing, and the idea was to play for as long as we could, essentially, until it felt like a natural ending. And we just ended up in these states, these complete flow states, and we would play for so long and just lose track of time. So I think at one point we were playing for 50 minutes, and that whole half hour in the middle was completely, time was gone in that moment.
Must be an amazing experience to lose yourself completely in the music like that.
Yeah, it's just when time disappears and you're so focused, it really changes the way you experience music and when you're playing it. And I think the biggest thing I learned whilst I was doing it was how to listen to the whole thing. I stopped listening to myself as an individual within a ensemble and started listening to the whole sound and didn't think consciously about how I was impacting that and just let that happen and listened to how everyone else was impacting that at the same time. And it changed the way that I now practice my music. It changes the way I compose and even the way that I work with other musicians. It's created this sort of way of communicating without words that I love.
Is there a tune or two from that Finnish experience that you could play for us now?
Yeah, there's a couple of polskas. The first one is called Kamen Antti, and the second one is called Från Latfjärd, and that's a tune from the Swedish-speaking border of Finland. So they're beautiful wee tunes that I'll play for you.
And does the name translate?
They're two people's names.
All right. And look, I just look over here and I see that there's a moss-covered ruin where some big stones have fallen down. Yeah. Would you care to sit on one of those stones and play?
Let's make a little home there.
Yeah, let's do it. Walking up through the trees there, we came across some spectacular looking mushrooms and possibly toadstools as well. What did you see there, Malin?
I love the fungus here. I mean, there's so many beautiful things, and I think that one was less beautiful. I think it was a dog sick fungus. But yeah, there's so many amazing things that you can eat here, in particular like the sorrel that covers all of the floor there, and then the chanterelles dotted around. And yeah, I think growing up here was incredible to be able to kind of live a bit off the land.
Did you learn to forage for things?
Yeah, I learned to forage for chanterelles and seps mostly. And we always had mackerel and fish from the sea, and we ate the venison that was off the hill. We had a vegetable garden as well, which was pretty nice. Again, that was a lot of homeschooling, was growing food and having vegetables and things. But there was always a healthy amount of foraging at the supermarket.
Would you be self-sufficient when the apocalypse happens, you know, and you're left on, on an island?
We always used to say that, yeah, if we could be anywhere in the world for the apocalypse, it would be here, definitely, because we'd have all the food, would be cut off, we'd have a nice supply of fuel.
I'm staying with you, if that's all right. Have you got room for me? So we've come over the top of the island now, or at least over the shoulder of the island, and we can see the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's just an infinite view out to America, nearly.
Yes, and you can see the white-capped waves in the distance, and the terrain here is more bracken and heather, and yeah. You might hear a stream.
It starts to get a bit more rugged at the back of the island, and the trees disappear a bit. And also just behind us is kind of the small isles, there's Egg and Rum. And it's just an incredible view from the beach that's on the far end.
Is this a place to play another tune?
I think so. It's such a nice view.
What would you play?
I'm going to play you a tune called You Are Not Alone. It's a beautiful Estonian slow air that was written by an electric guitarist called Marek Talts. And I was actually taught this by my teacher in Glasgow called Finlay MacDonald, who spent a lot of time in Estonia. And it's actually recorded and it's going on the album Helicline.
Great place to do it by the stream here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we fought our way through the bracken and the heather and ended up at this bothy, red roof, red tin roof.
This is a wee place called Ariane, and we used to have friends that came and stayed here very often. And we'd always come and hang out and sit and eat nice food under this sycamore tree. And it's now a wee bothy, so I'm dying to see it. I haven't seen it for 17 years or something.
Go inside, but we have to ring the ship's bell before we go in, don't we? There is a ship's bell here, 1945, it says.
I think the dinger's gone. It's just got a little chain.
It's a bit underpowered, isn't it? Yeah. Let's go in through the door. Inside here, there's a wonderful old stove, iron stove there with logs in it and a kettle and some stools around the stove and a wood floor, and then this huge communal table made of wood, and all the stones very raw on the walls, very untreated. But it must be a great place to have a communal dinner in here. Loads of candles because there's no electricity.
Yeah.
Must be incredibly atmospheric.
It must be beautiful, yeah.
Carried the fiddle all the way here, so if you'd play it for us, that'd be great. What are you going to play on the fiddle?
I'm going to play you a wee tune that I wrote when I was younger again. So I wrote this maybe when I was 15 or 16, but I called it Ellen Schoner in kind of memory of this place.
Amazing, and it was just wonderful to see you play it with your back to the spectacular view here, Malin. But I have to tell you that time is ticking on, and I think the audience is going to be assembling in the village hall for your gig, and I think we've got a bit of a walk to get there. So if it's all right with you, I'll say thank you so much for sharing your tunes, your stories, and this island with us, and let's get going.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Matthew. It's been a joy sharing this music with you, and thanks for having me back here.
Malin is an extraordinary talent, described as the future of contemporary folk. Malin has just walked a long way across the island and through the heather. I hope you're all right.
All good.
Yeah? So will you please welcome Malin Lewis and her band. really hope you enjoyed this episode of Folk on Foot as much as we enjoyed making it. There are over 60 episodes of Folk on Foot for you to explore, featuring amazing artists like Eliza Carthy, Johnny Flynn, The Unthanks, Kareen Polwart, Chris Drever, Sandra Kerr, Catherine Tickell, and many, many more. So please do explore our back catalogue. And if you like what we do, we really need your support to keep going. You can become a member and get great rewards, or you can simply buy us a coffee. To do either, and to sign up for our ad-free version, just go to folkonfoot.com/support us. Every penny we get goes back into making more episodes, so please do support us if you can. Before you go, here's a taster of another podcast that we love. Sometimes you just have to take your hat off to a fellow podcaster for having a simple but brilliant idea and executing it perfectly. That's what happens in Where Are You Going? The wonderful host, Catherine Carr, interrupts people going about their daily lives and asks them that question. Where are you going? Then a bit like Folk on Foot, each episode takes you on a little journey into the lives of the perfect strangers she meets. She's done it all over the world, and the stories she finds are unpredictable, funny, heartbreaking, silly, romantic, and often surprising. Here's Catherine to tell you more.
So we are off to the seafront to go do a photo shoot, and the vibe is like an alien princess on a walk of shame.
Just enjoying the sun and searching for sausage dogs.
I'll tell you where I'm going this morning. I'm going to see my mother in hospital. Oh. She's been in 3 months, so it ain't nice.
Where are you going? One simple question and countless surprising stories from perfect strangers.
I'm going all up to 125th Street.
What is it you're going to do there?
I got to go up to the bathroom, buy a pair of pants.
My name's Catherine Carr, and I'm the host of this podcast. There's no preparation, no research. I just travel to different places around the world and ask one question. Where are you going? The stories people tell me are amazing. They're beautiful, heartbreaking, funny, silly, and always surprising.
I'm going to therapy right now. That's why I'm laughing. You know, there's something about that bridge. I think I remember when I come out, I go, I was laughing on my way in, and I was crying on my way out.
Everyone has a story. You just need to be curious enough to find out.
Who am I? I'm just someone who's trying to figure things out.
Where Are You Going? Can be found wherever you usually listen to podcasts. You just never know.